We talked yesterday about freedom. Yesterday we addressed the question, is the value of freedom for itself, or is the value of freedom because with it you can do something else that's valuable? Is it intrinsic or extrinsic? And I argued for you that it is extrinsic. Being free has no value in and of itself. Being free is a means. When you're free, you can do things. And if you can do valuable things, so then then the being free itself is valuable. But if you can't do anything with it, then it isn't valuable. Just being free by itself has no value. If all you can do with your freedom is things of very little value, so then being free is of very little value. I hate to do this. I have to quote what the liberals say. I'm allergic to that. But you're right. But once in a time, once in a while, they could get something right by accident. If you imagine a person who's too poor to afford bus fare, and certainly doesn't have a car, he can't afford a taxi. And let's imagine that he lives in a dictatorship where they restrict people's movements. They don't allow them to travel without a pass, and it's given on a very prejudicial basis. And then there's a revolution, and they institute a new law, freedom of movement. Anybody can go anywhere they want. That's great, but he can't go anywhere anyway. I mean, he could walk, but that doesn't take him very far. He hasn't got enough money to make use of the freedom. So, how valuable is the freedom for him? He's free. Nothing's stopping him from going. There are no barriers. No guns to his head. No policemen. But he can't make use of the freedom. If that's the case, then they argue, and in this particular, I think they happen to be right, that although he has the freedom, it's not very valuable for him. You ask him, will you join the revolution for freedom of movement? He may say, well, it's good for other people, and out of generosity, for other people I can join the revolution, but it isn't going to do me any good, because I can't use it. I'm not able to use it. Imagine people are giving away free books in Urdu. That's some language in India, I think, or someplace, I don't know where it is. Some language, you know. Free books! But you don't read Urdu. So what good is it to you that they're giving away these free books?
Burn it in the fire.
Oh, good, good. I didn't think of that. That's right. But you can burn it in the fire. Even. So then it's worth. It's worth the price of fuel. But it's not worth the price of a good book because you can't read it. The value of freedom, the value of anything free, is only in terms of what you can do with it. So whether there are restrictions on you or there aren't restrictions on you, whether those restrictions hurt, whether they have any point, whether taking them off is a project that's worthy of your effort, depends upon what difference it will make for the things you can do. Being free by itself is not, doesn't make the difference. The difference is in what you can do with it. Yeah.
With this sort of being oppressed or being free, and you're both doing nothing with either. Being oppressed, you're doing certain things that aren't worth much, and being free, you're doing those same things that also aren't worth much. But with being free and doing those type of things, it could come a stage or a time that you might slip into more meaningful things of doing.
Which means that the freedom might become valuable when you do something different with it.
But it has that chance of becoming valuable.
Becoming valuable because you will? It'll become valuable because you will?
Do something with it.
That's my point. That's the only point I want. My point is, it's valuable because you do something with it.
But being oppressed will never come to that point.
Correct. So therefore, what is the value of freedom? The value of freedom is that with freedom, you can do things with it that are important. That's my point. Not just being free, but using the freedom to do things which are important. In yesterday's analogy, this was like having car keys, right? Having car keys is useless unless you also have the car, and the keys can start the car. Then the keys are useful. That was my example of something which is not important for itself, it's only important as a tool to do something else. And you're telling me, listen, it's important to be free because someday you might get the car. And then you have the keys to use the car, which is my point. It's car keys. You're not showing that it isn't car keys.
It could be the state of mind of having car keys. It's also
the state of mind of having car keys to use for a car. Correct. What you're anticipating is...
The peace of mind of having car keys in your pocket. You won't drive the car, you won't go anywhere with the car, but having car keys in your pocket makes you feel...
Because of the things you can do with it. But if you know that your car has four flat tires, and therefore with the keys you still can't go anywhere, it won't give you that peace of mind, will it? Because the keys are important, because with the keys you can go someplace. You may not get around to going to a place. It gives you pleasure to know that you can go if you want to go. But the value is in the fact that with it you can go, not in the thing itself. That's the only point that I wanted to make. When you look at freedom and ask how valuable it is, the answer is, well, what can I do with it? Not being free, but what can being free enable me to do otherwise?
Yeah. Isn't it possible that you can have meaning and value in your life without having basic freedom?
Oh, yes, of course. I didn't mean to imply that freedom is... I'm coming to this now. I didn't mean to imply that freedom, that without freedom you have no value in your life. I'm only addressing a much more limited question. Everybody thinks freedom is valuable. It is a valuable thing, not the only valuable thing. It is a valuable thing. I'm wondering why it's valuable. Why, right? Yeah.
It's freedom on the idea of freedom being like a releasing, you know, allowing, like opening the doors, you know. But couldn't it also be, if it's a means to get what you want, if there's a homeless guy who never gets any food on the street, says, shoot, I'll do a crime, I'll end up in jail, I'll have just what I want. I'll have three meals and a place to stay. You know?
This is not a hypothetical example.
Yeah, in America.
In fact, people who are in jail and get used to it, some of them, when you let them free, do a crime to go back because they can't face... Yeah, go ahead.
So, would that be their... giving them freedom to... If they had the freedom of choice of doing that, to confine themselves, you know? And the idea of freedom is not releasing, you know? People have this idea... I mean, the releasing allow you to do what you want to do, I guess. But the whole idea of freedom...
Look, you have to distinguish... First of all, you have to define what freedom is. And then you have to ask, will people like it? What kind of people will like it? Erich Fromm, whom nobody remembers anymore, wrote a famous book called Flight from Freedom, right? Because Escape from Freedom, because he gave a psychological picture of a whole class of people who are afraid to be free, and therefore automatically hem themselves in and lock themselves in. Freedom...
Being free is suffering.
No, that's... twisting it around. In order not to fight about the concept, the easiest thing to do is to say there are things that force me to act. Freedom means not having anything that forces me to act, or less things that force me to act. The more freedom you have means the less things that are forcing you to do one thing or another.
Because you can have good habits, but you're not free.
Okay, so now let's, I wasn't going to go this direction. You guys are pushing me down it's true that there's external freedom and internal freedom. And we haven't talked about internal freedom at all. External freedom is when the police are not pushing you around and, oppressors are not there, and to a certain extent, maybe certain limitations of nature don't stop you. There's a flood, I'm not free to go where I want to go. And then there is a concept of internal freedom, that I'm not subject to compulsions, inner compulsions. But that's much more difficult to explain. That's a much more difficult concept. All right, maybe we should talk about this. I can't continue tomorrow. We're on vacation tomorrow, but let's try. I understand what it means. The person puts a gun to my head. Although I still have free will, we've met this many times. The person puts a gun to the head and says, bow to the idol. Millions of people have chosen not to bow to the idol. But he definitely changes my freedom. He changes my freedom, he changes my options, he changes my alternatives, my outcomes. And if a person picks me up bodily and pushes me down in front of the idol, then I have no freedom at all. If there's a police barricade in front of the building I want to get into, I don't have the freedom to go in because they physically stop me from doing it. So here, the loss of freedom is, I want, and they've stopped me from doing what I want. How are we going to work it with internal freedom? People who suffer compulsions, addictions, often describe themselves, they use words, and if you analyze the words carefully, you see that the words are nonsense, and yet, they feel right. The words feel right, it feels like they're saying something reasonable, and yet, when you analyze the words, they turn out to be nonsense. This is where you get philosophical problems. Let's take a person who smokes. I'm not talking to anybody here, God forbid. But, somebody who's really addicted to smoking. Now he says, because he's heard me speak about it so many times, he says, I really don't want to smoke. I just can't help it. I just can't help it. I have this addiction, this drive, this need, this compulsion. I can't help it. I really don't want to smoke, but I can't help it. People talk like that, right? Now let's see. He's telling us he really doesn't want to smoke. Gosh, then how come he smokes? I mean, he does take out the cigarette and put it in his mouth and light up the match and inhale. So I don't get it. If he really doesn't want to smoke, how come he's smoking? Surely he does want to smoke. And that's why he's smoking, because he wants to smoke. Isn't that true? What do you mean? He doesn't have any desire to smoke?
I mean, he needs to know.
One second. He doesn't? I really don't want to smoke. That means he has no desire to smoke? That's got to be wrong. Of course he has a desire to smoke. Otherwise he wouldn't be smoking. So, if I take, he says, I really don't want to smoke. If that means I don't have any desire to smoke, that's clearly nonsense. Of course he has a desire to smoke. His problem is that his desire to smoke is so small, is so strong, he can't resist. So surely it would be nonsense for him to say, I don't have any desire to smoke. But he does say, I really don't want to smoke. And it does sound like there's something right there. Let's ask another funny question. So, if he really doesn't want to smoke, then who does the desire to smoke belong to? Somebody else? So how come he lights up if it belongs to somebody else? Now, jumping ahead to where we probably won't get, can you begin to see why certain schools of psychology would say that inside your head there's a committee? There's really a committee in there. There's three different ones rattling around in there. Why would they say a thing like that? Because over here, what we're saying sounds like nonsense. And one way to get out of nonsense is to split things up. The inside is A, B, and C. And A doesn't want to smoke, and B wants to smoke, and they're fighting with each other. It sort of works out okay if you do something like that. But okay, that's just to show you a motivation for Freudian psychology and Adlerian psychology and transactional analysis and all the other schools, which say that inside your cranium there's a committee, because if it's only one, you're going to make contradictions about that one and you won't be able to talk straight. So you split it up and say, you know, there's a whole committee, and then what I say here is about this one of the committee, I say over there is about the different one of the committee. But let's go back. So now, I'm telling you now, it comes from a very well thought of contemporary philosopher, and then Harry Frankfurt. So the smoker says, I really don't want to smoke. Clearly, he does want to smoke, so we're trying to make sense out of what he needs. Here's a first shot. This isn't quite right. We'll change it again, but here's a first shot. Maybe what he means is that he has contradictory desires. He does, of course, desire to smoke, otherwise he would never light up. But he also desires not to smoke. Bad for his health, for whatever reason.
A desire to smoke.
So he has a desire to smoke and a desire not to smoke. He has both desires. We do have times when we have conflicting desires. That's what makes life so interesting if you're a novelist and difficult if you're living it. Right? It's painful. You're at war with yourself. That's what ambivalence is usually about. I feel this way and I feel that way and I go back and forth because I have an inner conflict. Now, is that going to do the job? That's not quite right. Why is it not right? Why is it not right to say, well, he has conflicting desires. He has a desire to smoke and a desire not to smoke, and that's where the conflict arises. No, that's not, it can be one is stronger than the other. Now, what are we trying to explain? Is there an answer to my question? What are we trying to explain? The guy says, I really don't want to smoke. Right? That's what he says. But now he has two desires. Two real desires. One is a desire to smoke, and one is a desire not to smoke. So what justifies putting the really on one of them and not the other? Since they're both real, he really has both desires. So what puts the flag of victory on the desire not to smoke? Oh, this is what I really want. And that one, although it's real, I don't really want it. I mean, you know, we still haven't yet made complete sense out of what the guy's saying. We're not finished yet.
Could it be two things? That number one, he wants to smoke, but he doesn't want to get the result of smoking, like the means.
Let's say
he
so.
Wants the means, but he doesn't want the result.
Good. So now he has a desire to smoke because the smoking itself is pleasant, and a desire not to smoke because of the consequences. Right? What is it that justifies putting the word "really" on the second one rather than the first? Aren't they both real?
Couldn't it also be that it's not that he desires to smoke; it's that he's become like he needs it now.
I think the word "need" is just a word for a very strong desire. You know,
his goal is not to smoke, and his desire is to smoke. So he puts the really on the not smoking because that's his goal that he's trying to ultimately achieve.
Aha! And what's the difference between a goal and a desire?
It's good for him. The goal contradicts or gets in the way of his desire.
But what kind of thing is a goal? Is a goal not just another desire?
Well, now it's not the same desire anymore. Meaning,
correct, it's not the same.
Right, now it sets up, like, before the desire would be that you want to smoke or not want to smoke.
Right.
Now we're setting up a difference.
Yes.
Or at least between the two desires and understanding why they contradict and what's going on in the set. Because one, he's trying to do something, and on the other hand, it's clearly getting in the way. Being that he wants to do something, his mind tells him this is what I really want. And hence, he puts the really on the goal.
You're going the right direction, but I'm not hearing it clearly. By calling it a goal, when you use the word goal, do you mean that it's not really a desire? Something else? It becomes a different category?
But since it's a goal, that's why he would stress.
So, but now, what does the word goal do for you? What more does it say than it's a desire? You know, imagine a person who has opportunity to go to a concert and go to a hockey game. And he wants to go to both of them. Would he say, but I really want to go to the concert? He would never say anything like that. Because he really wants to go to the concert, and his problem is at the same time, in different places, and he can't do both of them. He would say, but I really want this one. He really wants both of them, and the real really applies to each one of them equally. What is there here that could justify putting the word really on one side and not on the other side?
It's like they're arguing on the same point. When you say, I want to go to the hockey game, I want to go to the football game, that's on the same night, same point. Goal is at the end. I mean, I could smoke now and I'd still be going toward my goal because then I'd smoke now and I wouldn't smoke for another 2 days.
I want to go to the hockey game, which is Wednesday night in town. And I want to go to the concert, which is in San Francisco, Thursday night. And the only way to get there is to take a train Wednesday afternoon.
But still, you can't do both.
Correct. Well, if one desires to smoke and one desires to not smoke, I surely cannot do both.
But the desire of the goal within it can incorporate the desire desire to smoke right now.
How could you do that? The goal is what? To be healthy? Well, what's the goal
of the
year?
The goal is at the end of whatever period, whatever his goal is, at the end of the year.
Let's go back. We lost the thread. This guy says, I really don't want to smoke. The first step forward was to say that inside his head, there's a desire to smoke and a desire not to smoke. So I ask, if that's the case, and that both desires are real, what justifies his saying, but I really don't want to smoke? Since he has a real desire to smoke and a real desire to not smoke, how come he puts the word really on the second one only? So he said, because the second one is special. It's not just another desire. The second one is a goal. So the word really goes on goals, not just on any old desires. So then, in my case, of the concert and the hockey game, he'll say neither is a goal. That's why the word really doesn't come up. But when one of them's a goal, then you can put the word really on the goal. So I ask, please cash in for me the word goal. What does the word goal do for me if it's just another desire? So if you take it long term, so I have the concert now and the football game tomorrow, and I got to take a train, so that's a goal because it's only for tomorrow night. And still, I wouldn't say that one is really and the other one's not really. This is real philosophy. It's, yeah.
The goal is not a desire. He's not getting pleasure out of not smoking. He's rationalizing. He's saying, I don't want to smoke, but at the same time, I'm getting, like, if I would smoke, I'm getting pleasure from that cigarette.
So what is it? If it's not a desire, what is it? You used a new word now.
It's a rationalization.
Okay.
I know it's going to be funny, but I love
it. Okay. So you see where he's going? He's taking your idea, only he's using a slightly different vocabulary. He's pushed it up. He's pushing it up into another realm. He's saying it's not desire against desire. It's not desire against goal, which probably is just another word for a certain kind of desire. It's a desire against the rationalization. Oh, that might put it into a different category. Of course, I really don't want... Okay, that'll be the next question. What kind of category is that? So we're moving in a relevant direction. You know, we're setting up the boxes in the right places, but eventually we're going to have to fill in the box.
It's your heart.
Huh?
It's your heart in your head.
Okay, we'll come to that. You know, that's three steps down the line. Yeah?
Maybe it has to do with how much effort you intend to put on. How much effort it would take to do something. Therefore, to go to the broad class, okay, you have to get on the train and...
You can set up cases where the effort isn't going to make the difference. I'm going to tell you the answer because otherwise we're never going to finish. Yeah.
What if we say that which he really wants, the goal, or whatever else you want to call it, is in line with his value system, whereas the other countries?
Okay. You guys have jumped three steps ahead. I'm going to get there, but I'm going to fill in the steps in between. Okay. Both of you are in the right direction. Yeah.
Basically, say so the mother doesn't give the chocolate to the baby because the baby desires it. Because the mother knows in years to come that the baby will be healthy. She's investing in his health. It's an investment.
You're right, but it doesn't tell me how to solve my problem. You're correct, and you're correct in the policy that we would undertake. But I'm asking, he says, I really don't want to smoke, and he has a live desire to smoke. So what does he mean? Now, if he says rationalization, you talk about long-term benefits, maybe you're in the same ballpark with him. But it's got to be, the terms of the answer have to fit the terms of the question. Last shot, man, I'm going to...
I don't see why they can't exist real close to one another. I can't see why the hockey game and the concert can't be back-to-back to one another. And just like, I want to quit, and you forget for a second, you have to pop. So like,
what justifies saying, I really don't want to smoke, when clearly I really do want to smoke?
It's just some, like you said, right? It's a rationalization. I'd say rationalization.
Oh, but I don't think we take it that way. I think when people say this, we know what they mean, and we identify with them, and we can feel it the same thing as they do. This is not just empty words. No, this describes a real person having a real problem. I don't think this is empty words. And the goal is to make sense out of the words. Listen, I'm happy for all the cows, but we don't have till 6 o'clock. Listen to what Frankfurt says. He says that you have desires on two different levels. People have desires to smoke, and desires to run, and desires to eat, and desires to possess items, desires to lose weight, desires to do things, to have things, to be things. That's one level. And then, one step up, if you want the fancy, highfalutin terminology that's called meta-desires, you have desires about your other desires. You take a person who really likes to sleep late. You just have to imagine this now. I mean, try to imagine such a thing. A person who really likes to sleep late, and therefore he misses appointments. And he says, I wish I didn't like to sleep late. I wish I weren't like that. It means I have a desire not to enjoy sleeping late. Now, if I just make it more convoluted, I have a desire not to have the desire to sleep late. Or, as several people have come here and told me, you know, I see all these people studying. See the guys in the just going 12, 14 hours a day? I really have no desire to do that. But I feel I'm missing out. I wish that I had that drive to learn. I don't have it, but I wish I had it. It means I desire to have the desire to learn. I don't have the desire to learn, but I desire to have that desire. These second level desires look down on your own psychology on the first level and you say, gosh, there are certain things in there that I wish weren't there, or there are certain things missing that I wish were there. These are desires about the desires you have or don't have. By the way, Frankfurt points out, there's no evidence that any animal has any such second-level desire. Second-level desires are a small portion of what we call self-consciousness. It's not the whole thing, it's a small portion. And there's no evidence that any animal has even this small portion. So if you come across those people who tell you that we're really just animals, you might pull this out of your head. Anyway, along with 1,000 other things you could pull out. Now, says Frankfurt, imagine, we'll make the contrast. If you have a conflict of two desires on the first level, like the desire to go to the concert and the desire to go to the hockey game, and they conflict, then either way you're going to lose something. Because you can't do both. You get one and you lose the other. It's impossible to do both, to satisfy both desires. Let's imagine a conflict between a desire in the first level and a desire in the second level. Watch that the conflict comes out different. The conflict doesn't have the same build, doesn't have the same structure. Let's take a person who has a desire to smoke, that's a desire in the first level. And on the second level, he has a desire to lose the desire to smoke. The first level desire is a desire for smoking, lighting up, puffing, and inhaling. The second level is a desire to lose that first level desire. Now, here's this guy. He has joined a group therapy class to work on getting rid of the desire to smoke. And he's paying $100 a session. He's really serious about this. And he's sitting there in the middle of the session, talking about how to, you know, avoid smoking and all the rest. And he's so nervous that in the middle of the session, he lights up a cigarette. Now, what is he doing? When he lights up the cigarette, he's satisfying the desire to smoke. And when he pays $100 for the therapy session, he's satisfying the desire to lose the desire to smoke. He's acting on both of them at the same time. Here the conflict is not a logical conflict. It's not that you can't do both at the same time. It's not like the hockey game and the concert. But it's rather that neither one can be completely fulfilled, completely satisfied while the other one exists. As long as you have the desire to smoke, the desire to lose that one isn't going to be satisfied. And as long as you have the desire to lose it, you're never going to fully enjoy your cigarettes. So, that's the kind of tension that exists between the first level and the second level. Now, Frankfurt says, when I say really The word really is a flag for the second level. The word really is a flag for the second level. If I have a conflict between a first level desire and a second level desire, the word really goes with the second level desire, not with the first level desire. And in our case, that fits very well. Because the guy's smoking. If he's smoking, he definitely has a desire to smoke. That's impossible to avoid. Otherwise, he wouldn't be smoking. What does he mean when he says, I really don't? I really don't want to? He's saying, I have a second level desire to lose the first level desire. There's the conflict, the tension between the two desires. And the word really goes with the second level desire. That's step one in understanding the difference. Now at least I have a difference to hang the peg on, to hang the flag on. They're not on the same level anymore. They're not the same thing anymore. And now you ask, that's okay. Still, I have a tension between second level and first level. So they're different, quite right. I could still ask, why does really go with the second level rather than the first level? And the answer is what he said and what he said. Somebody else said that usually the second level reflects your judgments and your values. Whereas the first level typically does not express that. The first level is something you find yourself with. You just find yourself desiring certain things, or without desires for certain things. To form a desire that I should lose another desire I have, or gain a desire I don't have, that's usually the result of a judgment. As he said, I would be better off in the end if the desires I have were different. Something subtracted or something added. And then the really becomes a flag for the judgment. The really becomes a flag for the judgment. The second level desire is produced by a judgment and a value and evaluation. And that's why it gets the flag, really. So, you have a desire there. If there weren't a desire there, it would never move you to act. That's why there has to be a desire there somewhere. There is a desire there, but this one on the second level reflects judgment, it reflects evaluation, it reflects your values. First level desire typically does not. And that's why when a person says, really, he uses it to flag the second level. That's the difference. This now, right, I'll take questions for 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'm going to apply this to freedom. That was my goal, yeah.
So what's the deal? What's the best tools for this stuff?
You mean to do it practically, to succeed? It's not my subject at the moment. Maybe we'll do it another time. Yeah.
Isn't the smoke, the action of smoking, bigger than just the word really? Because the word is not as substantial as the action. So.
I think this is very important. Listen to what's going on here. This guy is smoking. This guy is smoking. And he says, I really don't want to smoke. That would have caused a little surprise. If you really, really, really don't want to smoke, how come you're lighting up? So he says, I can't help it. I'm out of control. What does he mean? I'm out of control. Who's the one that's out of his control if it's not him? And if it's he, so what do you mean he's out of control? Out of whose control? He's out of his own control? What does that mean? So what he means is, this will enable us to take one step forward. What he means is this. I have the desire to smoke. I also have the desire to lose the desire to smoke. And the desire to smoke is so strong that it's winning the battle. Now, who am I? Who am I? So the reason we got into this trouble is we thought that I'm the whole package. And if I'm the whole package, then the desire to smoke is as much a part of me as the desire to lose the desire to smoke. They're both part of me. And then I'm divided against myself. So here's the pressure for the committee. We spoke about that 15 minutes ago, right? Here's the pressure for the committee. Although I'm not going to go all the way to a committee, but there's a pressure to shrink the I. To shrink the I down. Who am I? I'm the one who makes the judgments. I'm the one who makes the evaluations. I'm the one who has the values. And I'm represented by the second level desires. And the first level desires are attached to me. They're attached to me. They're real. They're inside the same cranium. They're batting around in the same psychology, but they aren't who I am. I am a part of the psychology inside this cranium. Not the totality of the psychology inside the cranium. I contract my identity and apply it only to values, judgments, and the second level desires that they generate. That's who I really am. Now, you can define what it means to be under a compulsion. What does it mean for me to be under a compulsion? Since I am the judgments, the values, the evaluations, and the second level desires, that's who I am. Suppose there's a first level desire that's so strong, it contradicts the second level and it's running. I can't, it's out of control. It produces my behavior. Under those conditions, I can say that I am not free. I am not free because I am the one making the judgments. I'm the one with the values. I'm the one who is represented by second level desires. And here, the second level desires can't control the first level desires. So, the truth is, we're just importing the same idea. Lose freedom means there's something outside of me that's forcing me to act. The way we solve the problem is to contract the me, make the me smaller, so that the desire to smoke is no longer me. It's no longer who I am. And when the desire to smoke, therefore, forces the action, then the real me, which is the one who makes the judgment, has the values, does the evaluation, has the second level desires, the real me is trapped. And that's what I mean when I say, I can't. I'm not free. I'm compelled. I'm not free. Because I'm not free to do as I would wish. I'm not free to do as I would wish. Means I make an evaluation, a judgment. This is what I think ought to be done. But my first level desires are too strong, and I'm not controlling them. Maybe I can't control them. In which case, I'm not free. Two corollaries. What happens if a person succeeds in overcoming or changing the first level desires? That doesn't change who he is. Doesn't change who he is. It just changes the conditions under which he's operating. Might make his life a lot easier when he breaks the habit of smoking. It makes his life a lot easier, a lot more consistent. Because now the first level has been brought into line with the second level. It's smooth now. It's smooth. It's cooperative now instead of being at war with him. By contrast, if a person changes a judgment, a value, changes an evaluation, he changes a second level desire, that strikes much closer to home. In that respect, he really is becoming a different person. If it's a small item, it's a small change. If it's a big item, it's a big change. But it's much more internal to who he is. He really is becoming a different kind of person. You take a person who used to be very competitive and believed in it. This is how mankind makes progress, by competing with one another and giving rewards to the best. And then changes his mind and decides that cooperation is very important. That is a big change in the person. That is not at all comparable to overcoming the desire to smoke or whatever. The change to the individual is entirely different. And, given what I've told you, whether or not I'm free depends, in part, on the values that I have. Let's imagine a case like this. A person has certain values, and his first order desires are consistent. They're consistent. He has the desires he thinks he ought to have. He has the desires that the second level tells him he should have. So he's perfectly consistent. Everything's fine. Now let's suppose he changes the second level. He changes his values, he changes his judgments, changes his evaluations, changes second level desires, and then the very same first level desires now are inconsistent with the second level. Now he will say he's not free. I'll give you an example. Let's start with competition, what I said before. Yeah, imagine a kid who grows up in a very competitive atmosphere. His parents are very successful. They're successful economically, and they're successful, let's say, in sports, whatever, and they run competition their whole lives. And their goal is to bring up the children in such a way they'll be good competitors. That's how you get ahead. And the kids are good. They're strong, they're aggressive, they're focused, they're, and they're good, and they succeed, and they talk the philosophy, and they accept the philosophy. So their instincts for aggressive behavior and competition go together with their philosophy, and they regard themselves as perfectly free. Now, they read, and they experience, and they talk to other people, and they begin to realize that this kind of philosophy is very dangerous, and has a lot of korbanos, it has a lot of losses, sacrifices. And gradually they come to see that this philosophy is not correct. Really, there ought to be a safety net for people who are going to lose, and cooperation is more important. That's what it does to a person's character. He's so aggressive. He loses the ability to be sympathetic, and he loses the ability to empathize him. So then, having changed their values, but you know that your habits and your interactions don't change so quickly. So now, he's changed his values. His second level now is restructured. And in the second level, what he says is, I desire to lose those competitive instincts. But they're not going to be lost so quickly. And now, those very same competitive instincts make him unfree. They're now compulsions. They're compulsions because they violate his values. Whereas, 10 years before, the very same instincts were not compulsions. They were not bad. They didn't reduce his freedom because they were consistent with what his values are. So whether or not you are free depends to a great extent on what your values are and how your first level desires fit together with your values. And therefore, when you are in a period of time when you are reconsidering your basic values, as people who come to yeshiva find themselves doing, because they learn that there are alternatives for basic values, and the values that they've been taught may be the product of short-sightedness and prejudice and Christian or post-Christian thinking or all sorts of other lovely roots for things. This is going to have a tremendous impact on whether the person experiences himself as integrated, consistent, and free, versus experiencing himself as at war with himself and unfree. Now, Rabbi Schiller, I don't know how many of you have heard Rabbi Schiller, but Schiller was really a deep thinker. He said once, many years ago, he used to be involved in creative writing. He said, there is no creativity without tension. If a person is looking for a tension-free existence, he's looking for an existence in which there will be no creativity. All creativity is the attempt to solve some problem. There's some obstacle that has to be overcome. There's something that has to be accomplished. It's not clear how to do it. Creativity is a response. If you don't feel the tension in the situation, if you don't feel that something's needed that isn't there, and that there's a loss impending because it isn't there, and it's a great gain available if we could just supply it, if you don't feel that, then there's no spur to be creative. That creates that inner tension. This inner tension, the tension of feeling unfree, because your values are out of step with your first level desires, this is the trigger for inner creativity. Building yourself. Developing yourself. Creating an identity for yourself. Not just taking the identity that your DNA and your environment molded into you and just playing it out like a robot for the rest of your life. But consciously evaluating, making judgments, adopting values, forming second level desires, and then working to bring the first level desires into consistency with the second level desires. That's creating for yourself an identity, and then working to enable that identity to function freely to determine what you do. Okay.